Hello and welcome back to Wired Podcast. My name is Leonardo Pasquale. I'm the head of training of Wired, a London-based wine training and event company. In this episode, Emma Symington, Master of Wine, who is the Education Development Manager for Wine Australia UK, will talk about some preconceptions people tend to have when it comes to Australian wines and discuss the reality of its wine industry. For anyone who would like to know more about Australian wines, please do log on to www.australianwinediscovered.com and you will find all the 200 plus downloadable open resource for you to learn more about Australian wines. Enjoy!
So we're the generic body for Australian wine. Our head office is based in Adelaide in Australia. But I obviously work over here in the AR office is in London, and we cover theoretically the entirety of EMEA, but realistically all my work is done in the UK and Northern Europe, and really just going out and talking to people, talking to trade about Australian wine, and trying, you know, to educate people a bit and give people some talking points when they're going out and selling Australian wine. So that's my role. So I am basically just going out there and talking to people about Australia all the time. And I think some of the preconceived ideas people tend to have about Australia that kind of crop up time and time again can kind of come down to three or four main ones. The first one being Australia's big. Then, you know, Australia's hot. I think if particularly for people who haven't been to Australia, if you're thinking about Australia in your head, you're probably thinking images of the red desert, the bush, perhaps tropical beaches. So all these kind of hot climate images. And then in terms of winemaking, I think there's obviously an idea of people have about Australia being quite modern, high-tech winemaking, perhaps looking at things like bulk wine, huge vineyards. So that's kind of where I thought we'd look at throughout this next half an hour and sort of unpick those few things and see to what extent they're true or false, and look at some realities along the way. So is Australia big? Well, yes. Quite clearly, Australia is huge. And I think here, actually, quite often, yes, people think it's big, but they don't realise quite how big it is unless you've been there. Because as you can see from this slide, it really is the size of a continent. It is bigger than Europe. So I think unless you've been there and sort of flown across the country, it's really hard to visualise just how big it is. So putting just a little bit of scale on this map, if you fly from Perth in Western Australia across to Sydney, that's about a 2,000 mile journey. It's about a 5-hour flight and you're crossing three time zones. So it's a similar kind of journey to travelling from London down to Cairo. So really quite a long flight. It is a massive country. So it's certainly always worth keeping in the back of your mind when you're talking about Australia, just how big it is. Because I think there can be a tendency for people to talk rather sweepingly about Australia. So talking about the Australian vintage or talking about Australian Shiraz always tasting like X, Y, or Z. But if you then come back to remembering just how big Australia is, you know, you wouldn't really think talk about the European vintage or saying all European wines taste the same. So that's definitely something that's always worth remembering about Australia. Another way to look at it, if you want another little snippet, Australia is actually bigger than the moon, would you believe? So the moon's diameter is about 3,400 kilometres, and Australia at its widest point from east to west is about 4,000 kilometres. So it really is a vast, vast country. So unsurprisingly, therefore, it is very diverse, both in terms of topography, in altitude, in climate, huge variety across the country. So no surprises then that, you know, wine from different parts of Australia all does taste very different. Moving on to the wine regions themselves, there's 65 wine regions in Australia, and don't worry, I'm not going to quiz you on this. There's probably only about 20 of them that we regularly see in export markets. A lot of them are pretty small, that tends to be only drunk domestically. There's about 20 of them that you tend to see over here in the UK and in other export markets. And as you can see, they're predominantly around the southern part of Australia. So you might be thinking, okay, it's a big country, 65 wine regions, that sounds like quite a lot. So it must produce a lot of wine. Well, the figures here is it's about 146,000 hectares of vineyard in Australia. Now, again, that might sound like a lot, but actually that's only about 4% of global plantings. Or to put it another way, it's about the same as Bordeaux and Burgundy put together. So if you remember back to how big Australia is versus the size of France, let alone the size of Bordeaux and Burgundy, it really doesn't produce that much wine in relation. But what it is a huge exporter. So only about a third of the wine Australia produces is drunk domestically in Australia, about two thirds is exported. And here in the UK, we're the number one export market by volume. And the UK and the, Australia and the UK off trade is the number one category and has been for the past 15 years. So we see a huge amount of Australian wine here in the UK. And I think that's why there can be this perception that Australia produces a vast amount of wine. It does produce quite a bit, you know, 4% of global plantings is not nothing, but it's certainly not anything in comparison, particularly to, you know, the big producers of France, Italy and Spain. So I touched on very briefly when we were just talking about how big Australia is to the varied climates. And it really shouldn't be a huge surprise when you consider how big Australia is that, you know, climates in Australia are very varied. And I think there is this perception that Australia is hot. And it's true, it is a hot country. If you flipped Australia into the Northern Hemisphere, it would occupy the same latitude as essentially the entire northern part of Africa, the Mediterranean Ocean, and the very southern Mediterranean part of Europe. So it is relatively close to the equator. So what that means is wherever you are in Australia, you always have this very brilliant sunlight, very high sunlight intensity. But that doesn't mean that the entirety of the country is hot, because there are these cooling influences. One of them in particular being the Great Southern Ocean. So if you can remember from the map I showed you a minute ago about where all the Australian wine regions are, they're predominantly around the southern part of Australia. And that's really because, yes, it is relatively further south, obviously, so away from the equator. But because of this southern ocean that has such a moderating effect on the climate. So the Southern Ocean is a very cold ocean. All the waters comes up from Antarctica. So it really acts to moderate the climate in all of these coastal regions. And I hope you can just about see this quote that I've put on this slide from Brian Crozer. So I think it illustrates this really nicely. So he says, the Great Southern Ocean creates the same range of climates at, and this is where I can't quite see a little quote, move this, at 33 to 40 degrees south, as is found in the Northern Hemisphere between 40 to 47 degrees north. So really what that means is the climate at these latitudes is much cooler than you would otherwise expect, and that's simply down to the effect of this cool Southern Ocean. And then the other thing that's worth always mentioning in terms of cooling influence is altitude. So as I'm sure you're all aware, the general rule of thumb here is that for every 100 metres you go up in altitude, temperatures decrease by about 0.65 degrees C. So obviously the higher you go, the cooler it is. And actually Australia's wine regions, many of them are much higher than a lot of European wine regions. So you do have this cooling influence from altitude. Now it says on here the highest Australian wine regions are up to about 1,000 to 1,200 metres. Actually, I did just check, and the highest vineyard at the minute in Australia is up in the New England GI, which is in New South Wales, and that's at 1,320 metres. So real significant altitude up there. So really cooling the climate because of that altitude. So when you're talking about altitude in Australia, there's three major, I suppose, geographical areas of elevation that's worth mentioning. So over in Western Australia, you've got the Darling Scarp. Now this isn't particularly high, it's only up to about 400 metres in terms of altitude, but it does add enough influence of altitude to cool, particularly the inland parts of Great Southern. So places like Franklin River, Porongarup and Mount Barker, all up about kind of 300 metres in altitude because they're on the Darling Scarp. So that is adding some cooling influences over there. More importantly, across in South Australia, you've got this Mount Lofty ranges. So these start in the foothills of Maclaren Vale, run up through the Adelaide Hills, up through the Eden Valley, and then into the Clare Valley. So it's all the same geological area of elevation. And that's really important in terms of moderating the climate in those regions. So the highest parts of the Mount Lofty ranges are in the Adelaide Hills, just outside Adelaide, getting up to about 700 metres, and the highest vineyards are kind of at 500 or 600 metres. So really cool, those vineyard sites, and that's where you get sparkling wines Grip made, lots of Chardonnay and Pinot Noir and Sauvignon Blanc in the Adelaide Hills because of this elevation, cooling the climate there. And again, that's why the Eden Valley is so different to Barossa Valley, even though they're right next to each other, they're contiguous regions, but the Eden Valley is much higher. So Barossa Valley kind of sitting at about 200, 250 metres. Eden Valley is going up to about 550 metres. So much, much higher. So you're getting coolness because of the elevation, also extra breezes. It's much windier up in the Eden Valley. So this is why you get the difference in styles between Eden Valley and the Barossa Valley. But then as you can see from this map, the major area of elevation is this Great Dividing Range. That runs right down the eastern coast of Australia, right up from up in Queensland and right the way down through into Victoria. And it adds elevation, particularly to vineyard regions in New South Wales and in Victoria, cooling the climates in a lot of these regions. It's also got a very important aspect in terms of in the summer, there can be tropical weather systems that sort of barrel down the eastern coast of Australia. Basically, they hit into the Great Dividing Range and they dump all that rain. So unsurprisingly, most of the wine regions are either on the top or the western side of the Great Dividing Range, so in the rain shadow, so they're not affected by those vintage rains. And then off the bottom here, you've got Tasmania. Now I said earlier that latitude is not cooling anything in Australia because it is relatively close to the equator. Tasmania is the one exception to this because that sits at a latitude sort of similar to Northern Rhone. So it is, you know, a little bit cooler because of latitude than the rest of Australia, but also pretty cool because you've got obviously totally surrounded by that cold Southern Ocean. Now, just to illustrate what I've just been talking about, I just popped this map on here. So this is minimum temperatures with a 30-year average. And I think it's really interesting because you can really pick out where those areas of elevation are, and particularly if you're looking at that Great Dividing Range down that eastern coast. Much, much cooler, but obviously up at the higher altitudes. And you can also see where the Mount Lofty ranges run down in South Australia. Now, just to illustrate what I've just been talking about, that yes, Australia is a hot country, and there really are warm inland regions, very much so, in terms of winemaking, but you've obviously also got this influence, coastal influence and influence of altitude cooling climates. So you do have a huge diversity in terms of wine regions. So I've just got four quick slides to flip through just to show you this, to see the differences between the Rhine regions. So Rutherglen Glen is in Victoria, right inland in Victoria, so very continental climate, absolutely no influence from the ocean. And as you can see, it's only sitting at 170 metres altitude, so very little influence from altitude as well. So it's a hot region, which shouldn't be a surprise if you think about what sort of wine styles are made in Rutherglen Glen, because it's particularly famous for its fortified wines, you know, the Rutherglen Glen Muscats and Topakes, when they need very, very ripe grapes in order to make those styles. So you've got the mean January temperature there at 23.7 degrees C, so hot region. Then compare that to the Barossa Valley, so in South Australia again here. More of a Mediterranean climate. There is a little bit of ocean influence here. You do get some of those breezes coming through, but still warm, you know, 21.4 degrees C, that mean January temperature. A little bit of altitude, but not a huge amount. And then heading down to the Yarra Valley. So this is about an hour's east of Melbourne, down in Victoria. So here, there is a bit of altitude in parts of the Yarra Valley, the upper valley, getting up to upper Yarra Valley, getting up to about 350 metres. Mostly continental, but again, some maritime influence from that cool Southern Ocean. And you can see here the mean January temperature, much cooler, 18.7 degrees. Unsurprising, you know, Yarra Valley is particularly well known for its Chardonnay and Pinot Noir. And then compare that to Tasmania. So as I said, Tasmania is the one part of Australia which has some cooling influence from the latitude of, and then obviously totally surrounded by that cold Southern Ocean. So it very much is the coldest region in Australia. Temperate climate, very strong maritime influence, and you can see that mean January temperature being so, so much lower there, 16.8 degrees C. So very cool, and particularly well known for sparkling wines. So absolutely incredible sparkling wines coming out of Tasmania. So I think then very quickly, we've just talked about, yes, Australia is big and probably a lot bigger than perhaps a lot of people perceive. And yes, Australia is hot, but it does have this quite diversity despite that, and because of various influences, including that Southern Ocean and the influence of altitude. So unsurprisingly, therefore, there's a huge diversity in terms of wine styles that are produced in Australia, and depending on the region and depending on its topography and all the other aspects as to what is planted there. So I suppose the next preconception people often have about Australia is that it's modern. Well, yes, quite clearly it is a New World country. The first varieties, the first vines didn't go out until 1788 with the first fleet. And it wasn't really until the early 1800s that things began to kick off in terms of viticulture. Actually, it was a handful of predominantly Scottish people who really kick-started viticulture in Australia, the MacArthur family being one of them, but particularly famously a guy called James Busby. So James Busby was a Scottish horticulturalist. He moved out to Australia in, I think, 1824. And then in 1831, he actually came back to Europe and spent 6 months travelling the vineyards of France and Spain. I mean, tough job, hey? And he was collecting cuttings of vine varieties wherever he went. And he ended up with 650 different cuttings. Each of them were packaged up individually and then shipped back to Australia with him. Now, 362 of those survived the voyage back to Australia, and those were then divided into two. Half were planted in what is now Sydney's Botanical Gardens. For any of you who've ever been to Sydney, you'll know exactly where I mean. And the other half, James planted at his property called Kirkton Park up in the Hunter Valley. And from there, you know, other people were bringing in cuttings too. Those vines were propagated. Further cuttings were taken and then planted in other parts of Australia. And it wasn't long really before commercial viticulture was happening across Australia. By the mid-1800s, there was commercial viticulture in every state. And actually the first export of Australian wine to the UK was in 1854. So we've been drinking Australian wine over here for a very long time. You know, we have quite a long relationship with Australian wine. So yes, it varies, very much is modern, but that's not really the whole part of the story, because I think something perhaps a lot of people don't really realise about Australia is it's actually home to the oldest vines of a number of different varieties in the world. So the oldest Shiraz is in the Barossa Valley, planted in 1843. That now goes into Langmuir's Freedom Shiraz. That's imported by Berkman over here. The oldest Grenache is planted at Cirillo Estate. It was planted in 1850. That's imported by GMB Shippers. The oldest Mourvèdre in the world, that was planted in 1853. Now goes into Hewitson's Old Garden Mourvèdre, imported by FMV. And the oldest Cabernet Sauvignon in the world was planted in 1888, also in Barossa. And that is Penfold's Block 42 Kalimna Cabernet Sauvignon. So a really incredible heritage of old vines. And that was all in the Barossa. But actually it's beyond that as well, because actually the oldest Dolcetto in the world is planted at best in Grampians down in Victoria. And that was planted in 1865. So quite an incredible history of old vines in Australia, which might be a surprise until you remember about phylloxera. So as I'm sure you're all aware, phylloxera decimated the vineyards in Europe back in the 1860s onwards. And eventually all those vineyards had to be uprooted and then replanted on grafted rootstock that was resistant to phylloxera. Yes, I know there are some small segments in Europe where there was no phylloxera and there are still some old vines remaining, but the vast majority of European vineyards had to undergo this uprooting and replanting. Now, phylloxera did go to Australia in 1877 into part of Victoria, but it never really spread beyond that. So there's a bit of phylloxera in parts of Victoria and also in parts of New South Wales, but the entirety of South Australia, Western Australia and Tasmania are all phylloxera free to this day. So this is why all these old vineyards have remained, because there's never been any need to grub them up and replant. And many vineyards are still planted on their own roots like this. So important are these old vines, particularly in the Barossa, that they actually have this old vine charter. This was started in 2009 as a way for them, both internally and also externally to consumers, to really talk about these old vines and celebrate them. So the charter is, as you can see, it's quite simple. So they classify old vines as anything older than 35 years old. And then survivor vines, anything older than 70 years. Centenarian vines, anything older than 100 years. And ancestor vines, anything older than 125 years in age. And you do begin to see these on bottles over here now, which is great to see. So to put some figures on here, in the Barossa, there's just over 11,000 hectares of vineyard, predominantly in the Barossa Valley, a little bit in the Eden Valley. Of that, 2,500 hectares are classed as old vines, so more than 35 years old. So that's over 20% of the region. And actually, there's just over 200 hectares more than 100 years old. That's about 2% of the region. So quite incredible that they still have this huge amount of old vine vineyards in the Barossa. And really something I think they should celebrate even more than they are down now, because it's something that's very, very special. And then I suppose the other part of, yes, Australia being modern, yes, it is in terms of viticulture, but geologically speaking, if you consider it that way, Australia is actually the old world and Europe is the new world. And I say that quite simply because the oldest rocks on the planet are found in Australia, and they've been dated to 4.4 billion years old. So that's only 200 million years younger than the planet itself, which I find quite mind-boggling. Now, those particular rocks aren't in any wine regions, but even if you look in wine regions, you're looking at a scale totally different to what we see over here in Europe. So, for example, in the McLaren Vale, they've done quite a lot of research into their geologies and soil types in the region. They found they've got 40 different geologies within the region, and the oldest one is 550 million years old. Now, if you compare that to, say, the Paris Basin, which is the geological area of northern France, that covers the Loire, Champagne, Burgundy, that dates to about 2.5 million years old. So a total order of difference to what you're seeing then in McLaren Vale at 550 million years old. So I think quite fascinating, and something, again, I think a lot of people don't necessarily realise about Australia, but it is home to these incredible old geologies. What that means also, though, is it's incredibly diverse in terms of soil type, because Australia's been on its own for so long, for over 100 million years on its own. It's been very, very eroded. If you think about that great dividing range I talked about, so the oldest peak there is just over 2,000 metres, so not super high, but in geological history, that would have been taller than the Himalayas. But because Australia's been on its own for so long, it's been so eroded, all those peaks have weathered down quite a lot. So there's a huge amount of diversity in soil types in regions. So again, just talking about McLaren Vale, there's actually 19 different soil types within the region, everything from sand to clay to loam. So it's not so simple as when you're talking about European wine regions, when you might be able to talk about one or two soil types. It's much, much more complex than that. And then just touching briefly, because I know we're getting on with time, about bulk wine, because I can think again it's something, bulk wine and branded wine is obviously something people think a lot about Australia, and yeah, the reality is here, yes, I mean particularly in the UK, 80% of what we import into the UK from Australia is imported in bulk, you know, right, obviously the brands and supermarket owned brands and all that sort of thing. But I think that's not necessarily a bad thing. On the one hand, you've got actually importing in bulk is much more environmentally friendly than importing in bottle, much more sustainable. And actually it's got benefits as well in terms of quality for the wine, because when you're bulk shipping in bulk, you're shipping in a big flexi tank. So it's got a very low thermal inertia. And if you think when you're shipping across the equator, you're obviously going across hot places, you might be sitting on the dock on a port for a while. And so it takes a long time for a big body of liquid to heat up and change temperature versus a small bottle. Actually, the temperature in the bottle can change quite significantly. So it can be much better for wine to be shipped in flexi than actually in bottle. But that's just one part of Australian wine. You know, obviously, because we're such a huge market for volume Australian wine here in the UK, we do see all those big brands. You know, we see a lot of the, should we say, the lower priced end of Australian wine. But that is really not the whole picture. It's actually a very small part of the picture. because there's over 2,400 wineries across Australia, and 75% of those produce less than 100 tonnes. So there's a huge number of small winemakers, small wineries doing really exciting things. And these are often the guys who are working sustainably, biodynamically, organically, and often working perhaps with alternative varieties. I think at the beginning I said, when people think about Australia or talk to me about Australia, you know, Shiraz and Chardonnay are the varieties they talk to me about. Unsurprising, you know, Shiraz accounts for about 25% of all plantings in Australia. But again, the reality is there's actually over 130 different varieties planted. And I think recently there's been a real increase in interest in some of these alternative varieties, particularly Southern Mediterranean ones, things like Touriga Nacional, Nera d'Avila, Fiano. All of these things are being planted now, and people are very excited about them, but tends to be from the smaller winemakers. But I think this is where Australia actually has a bit of a benefit, if you like, perhaps for the on-trade in particular and the independent off-trade, because all of these brands are going to be going into, you know, the supermarkets, and, you know, that's one segment of the market. But beyond that, you know, Australia has a huge amount of exciting wines from all across the country. You know, I've talked about that diversity in terms of climate and style. And there's a lot of opportunity for people to try and sell some of these more exciting varieties, you know, different styles of winemaking. And I think for a lot of consumers, there's a real trust in Australia and brand Australia, whether they've been there on holiday or, you know, for a lot of people, it's where they started off drinking wine. So they kind of keep this trust in Australia. And so when you can go and say, oh, I've got this Australian wine, but it's made from a, you know, cool grape variety or this tiny production doing something different, they can actually be really easy sells, even though they're a hand sell, they're not a hard sell. So I think there is a lot of opportunity there.